You're listening to the ISF Podcast for your organization's better cybersecurity. Your host, ISF CEO Steve Durbin, is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today's special episode features Steve's recent Business Matters broadcast interview with Juliet Foster, featuring conversation about critical cybersecurity challenges facing organizations today. Steve and Juliet discuss targeted phishing, the growing threat of crime as a service, the increase in AI-driven cybercrime, and more.
Hello, I'm Juliet Foster, and welcome to Business Matters. Cyber attacks are the scourge of modern business life, and if current trends are anything to go by, the danger is unlikely to recede anytime soon. A report by the cybersecurity company Checkpoint Software estimates that in the first quarter of 2025, businesses worldwide experienced an average of 1,925 cyber attacks per organization per week. That's a 47% increase compared to the same period a year ago. Well, the numbers not only reveal the sophistication of the assaults, but the brazenness of those who planned them. No company, regardless of size, is immune, and the consequences for those caught off guard can be painful. The British high street giant Marks & Spencer took a £300 million hit to its trading profits after a major cyber assault. So what should businesses do to protect themselves? And has geopolitical uncertainty emboldened the hackers? I'm joined in the studio by Steve Durbin. Steve is Chief Executive of the Information Security Forum, or the ISF, a global non-profit that helps businesses manage cyber risks. Steve, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. First of all, what's your reaction to those figures?
Well, I think the thing about the whole industry is that we are inevitably maturing. So with that, from a negative perspective, you would expect to see these sorts of numbers increase for two reasons. First, the attacks are increasing. There's no question about that, because it is much easier to actually perform some form of attack. But secondly, of course, people are monitoring it more closely as well. So some of the things that perhaps were escaping under the radar are now being picked up. I think, you know, what I would say is that, yes, it is increasing. Those of us in the industry know that it's increasing. And I think actually, if we look around generally, people are becoming so much more aware now of some of the challenges of operating in a technological environment that those are the sorts of numbers we're going to see going forward.
But does it mean that we've run out of time this year, at least, to break that upward trajectory? We've just simply got to run with it.
I think we do. I think we do have to run with it. I don't think there's any option other than to do that, I would say, Juliet. The bad guys only need to get lucky once, and they can cause havoc. And so the sorts of numbers you're seeing are them plugging away at it, trying to break down defenses, trying to find a way through. And on the defensive side, of course, we have to be at the top of our game 24/7. And that's just impossible. It doesn't matter what industry you happen to be in, or even if you're an athlete, you know, you are never going to be able to maintain a peak performance. So my point is that we will always see attacks taking place. And the more we see attempting, the more we'll eventually get through.
But what is not in dispute is that these attacks have become more sophisticated in their planning and their execution.
Yes.
What's your take on that? Because you're an industry veteran. You've seen a lot in your time.
I think there are a few things that are going on. Certainly back in the day, you know, when we used to talk about attacks, everybody immediately thought of this hooded individual in the kitchen. We've matured so far beyond that. Crime now, cybercrime in particular, it's a real entrepreneurial industry. It's very large scale. And the big criminal operations are large scale enterprises. So they do have all the things that you would expect in terms of R&D, in terms of support infrastructure. So if you look at it from that perspective, we shouldn't be surprised because of this maturing. The other thing that's happening, of course, is we're now seeing AI coming into its own in this place. You don't just have to have your own skill sets. You can go online. We have crime as a service, which is fairly widely spread. So you can purchase a particular element that you might want to try and drop on a particular customer that you're targeting, an organization that you're targeting. They'll provide you with 24/7 help desks. In some cases, you may even get your money back if it doesn't work. So we're de-skilling to a certain extent as well. So the point of entry for a cyber criminal has lowered considerably.
Oh.
And I think that will continue as AI becomes much more sophisticated.
Yeah, I do want to look at AI a little bit later in that conversation. But what I want to pick up on is this idea of these crimes being highly organized, very industrial. That does appear to suggest that this type of crime is also connected to other areas of criminality. If that's the case, are we talking about gangs that are running this?
We are. I think we always have to be careful about which sort of cyber criminal we're talking about. So obviously you have state, nation, backed actors, highly sophisticated, not a particular challenge in terms of resourcing. They will typically be going after government-to-government type.
So that's more of a geopolitical cyber crime.
Absolutely. But then if you come back a little bit from that, organized crime has certainly moved into this space because it's hugely lucrative.
Mm, rich pickings.
Very rich pickings indeed. And again, with some of those organized crime bosses, putting some of the money that's required into this particular area, in terms of the potential return on investment you can get, if you're a business leader in that space, you'd certainly be investing. So this is why I always refer to them as entrepreneurial organizations, because they do have business plans. They do understand where they can get a return. And so the days of it being a fairly haphazard, let's give it a shot, are pretty much long gone. We still have some of those, but I always look at those as the sort of entry level. And then if you've proved yourself there, you'll get a bit of a reputation and you can move up.
Obviously, it creates incredible problems for law enforcement, but that's a conversation for another day. But let's take it back to the here and now. I mean, look, would you say from your experience that big companies are more vulnerable to cyber crimes than smaller companies? Or have we now reached the point where size is really irrelevant?
I think with large organizations, they obviously have more resources available to make life difficult or more difficult for the cyber criminal. But we also have very complex supply chains now that obviously are made up of small to mid-size companies. If you look at the UK, vast majority of businesses in the UK are small to mid-size. If you go across to Europe, the same would be true in Germany and many of the other European countries as well, and also in the United States and Australia, of course. So an easier way of accessing some of this really tasty information, if you like, high-value information, is often via the third party. So you don't necessarily need to be attacking the larger enterprise. You can target a smaller to mid-size, which probably doesn't have the same level of defense, maybe not the same level of awareness. And because it's in the supply chain and sharing information, you can then access through to the larger enterprise. So a lot of larger organizations now are having to spend very much more time not just protecting their own specific defenses, but also looking at their supply chain and really advising them on what they should do, and much more importantly, perhaps, why they should do it.
And it's interesting because you kind of answered the question I was going to put to you just now, in fact, and that is, how do you choose your victim? Because the reality is that there are hundreds, thousands, millions of victims mm-hmm. to choose from, and even just a random selection can lead you to the bigger prize.
That's absolutely right. And I suppose the sadder element of it, really, because people listening to this may take the view that organizations should be able to look after themselves, but we mustn't forget that organizations are essentially made up of people, the likes of you and I. We too fit into that supply chain. And so the targeting of the individual, because we're all technologically enabled in some way, shape or form, right? We'll have phones, we'll have laptops, we'll have tablets, we'll be accessing our bank accounts, we're doing all sorts of things. That's also quite an interesting way to begin, certainly on a much more industrial level. It's a bit like trawling for fish, if you want to look at it that way. If you throw your net over, draw your boat through, you will pick up something. And it's the same with at that sort of people level, if you like. If you put enough fishing out there with a PH as opposed to an F, then people will inevitably respond, and then you'll be in there and you can do all sorts of things with the information you've gathered.
Absolutely. There are huge questions as well about staffing within organizations and upskilling and preparing people for AI, how to use it and how to actually combat the bad guys. But in terms of risk, would you say that there are some sectors which are more at risk than others because of what they do? Just as examples, pharmaceuticals and defense. Now, if they were hacked, the consequences could be very serious.
Oh, absolutely. I think if you look at traditionally what's happened, the financial services organizations have always tended to be the prime targets because that's where the money has been. Increasingly, of course, the ability to monetize, as you rightly point out, in the pharma space has dragged people more into that. The value of intellectual property in there. One of the things I've always been afraid of and worried about is not so much the stealing of data, but just the tweaking of data.
So manipulating
the manipulation of it so that you don't even notice, perhaps. And so you may then be producing product that is essentially flawed, or you may be making decisions that are flawed. So I think there's that component. And you're absolutely right to point out defense. Today, of course, with all that's going on in the world geopolitically, the defense sector is certainly under attack in a very different kind of way, not just in terms of trying to exfiltrate information around perhaps product development, weapons development and so on, but also about exactly what is going on, where are some of these things going.
So some planning of espionage as well.
Absolutely.
But look, we can talk about the responsibility on the part of sectors and companies, but what about regulation? Do you think that the current state of regulation is actually keeping pace with the evolution of these attacks or that entire landscape? And how can it keep pace? Because everything is changing so quickly. That's always going to be a constant battle, isn't it?
It is. I probably need to say right up front, I'm not a big fan of regulation for a couple of reasons. The first and most importantly is that regulation always tends to lag the market. And so it's always going to be playing catch up. I think the second reason why I'm not a big fan of it is that a lot of regulation, of course, is made by politicians who may not be getting necessarily best advice in terms of what's in the best interest of the industry. Regulation, I do think, has a role to play, but solid regulation and therefore compliance does not equal good security. And we need to be very clear about that. Good security, in the majority of cases, does equal good compliance. So it's about how you go about doing this.
Striking the balance between the two.
It is. And my fear with the regulation piece, because we're hearing so much about it now, and frankly, it is beginning to stifle business. But my fear with regulation is that we move into something of a tick box exercise where, you know, at least I've complied with this and this. So if something does happen, at least I can say, I covered myself. And that's what I mean when I say that good security doesn't necessarily flow from an adherence to
regulation. So it's basically down to the sectors themselves to set their own regulatory path because they're in there, so to speak. They know what's going on. They know what they can do, what needs to be done.
I think it is to a certain extent. I think what any business leader that you speak to will say is they want very clear guidelines. Give me the guidelines and I'll operate within them. But those guidelines have to make sense from the business perspective. So you have to have been consulted. And in the sort of area we're talking about, that does mean you have to have a fairly intimate understanding of the different vertical sectors and what's required. Finance, yes, highly regulated industry, has been so for many years. A lot of that regulation has been brought about by the banks, the insurance companies themselves being involved in it and determining
what makes sense. Sometimes following the financial crisis as well.
Exactly, and in response to that. My concern is that we're starting to see government getting overly involved in areas perhaps where they're not best placed to be involved without some of the support, the advice and guidance that is so necessary.
Interesting, though, because there is the argument that governments perhaps need to go further to a certain extent and mandate cybersecurity compliance for companies which operate in very sensitive sectors. I talked about defence and pharmaceutical, but also energy or healthcare.
Yeah.
So what should or could that look like if a government was brave enough to venture into that territory?
I think we do already have some fairly strong guidelines for critical national infrastructure, which are the sectors that you're referring to there. I think where I get more worried is when we move outside of that and we begin to try to regulate what you or I do. Because I think we have to understand that to a certain extent, cybercrime is facilitated by the internet. The internet was never regulated. We missed an opportunity to do that many years ago. And so I'm not saying don't regulate at all. What I'm saying is let's look at it in a measured way. Let's look at what is possible. So let's actually be very sensible about what we can do.
In other words, standing away from the noise, because there tends to be a lot of noise when you had a security breach.
Exactly. And that's where the politicians then begin to see an opportunity. And before we know it, we've created something that's very difficult to wind back.
So look, we understand where you lie on this subject about regulation, that it's valid up to a point.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, it has to be a hand-in-hand partnership between governments and businesses. But also as well, what should businesses themselves be doing to tailor their risk profile around individual perceptions of what is a genuine risk? In other words, is there an acceptable universal definition of risk that all businesses, regardless of what they do, how big or small they are, should be buying into?
I would say not. And some people may disagree with me on that, but I would say not. And the reason I say that is that in my experience, pretty much every business I've ever worked with or dealt with has been individual to a certain extent. So they will all have their different risk appetites. And that may change over the life of an organization. So you would adopt a different risk appetite, for instance, if you're about to launch a new product, or if you were about to move into a new market, or if you had the misfortune to be in a market that suddenly had a war breakout. So there are lots of different things in the life of an organization when we think about risk. So you will always start with your basic level of what is acceptable. You have to protect your employees. You have to protect your shareholders. You have to protect your customers. You have to make sure that the business itself is robust. We talk a lot to my organization about protecting the crown jewels, the things that absolutely have to be looked after in order for your business to still function. So all of that gets rolled into the risk mix. And frankly, businesses have been very good at doing that for a large number of years. So what we're now doing is we're adding cyber into that space. So for me, businesses know how to manage risk. What they do need to understand is that cyber risk is not that different. It's just a different component as far as a business is concerned, something else that we have to manage. So put it into the same process that you've already set up. You've probably got it in a very rigorous way because you're running a successful business, and off you go. So let's not overcomplicate it.
Right. So just treat it as any other risk.
Absolutely.
It's no different to any other risk.
At the risk level, it's not. Obviously, it has its different complexities. But the point is, if you can look at it as just yet another risk that we have to deal with, then suddenly light bulbs begin to go on in boardrooms because, okay, we get risk.
Yeah,
we understand
it's
that.
Another responsibility, basically.
That's absolutely right.
But let's throw it back onto the companies themselves, because you work with a lot of companies telling them or showing them what they can do to protect themselves. But have you ever come across a situation where perhaps a company is frighteningly casual about its cybersecurity dangers because it feels, you know what, we're a really big brand. So because we are known in whatever the field is, no one's going to touch us. Do some companies rely too much on their profile as a deterrent?
I would say not anymore. I think we've seen some fairly large scale attacks just this year alone with very large brands.
Certainly Marks and Spencer, as I mentioned in the introduction.
Marks and Spencer being one, of course, but Dior being another one. Mm. So brands that perhaps people would think, oh, I thought they would have been good enough. The sad thing is it's not about being good enough. If you are determined, you can pretty much breach any organization out there. So what organizations have to do is not bury their head in the sand, and not many of them are, but they have to plan for the day when it happens. So they have to go through a fairly rigorous
process.
Work on
the possibility that it will happen, even if
Absolutely.
It doesn't.
Absolutely. And then how are you going to respond to that? Because that's the important piece. What is your response mechanism? Because that will determine whether you're viewed as being a competent company versus one that perhaps hasn't done his homework. And the impact that can have on shareholder confidence, on valuation, but much more importantly, just on cleanup, the cleanup cost, which can run for months and months. Those are the sorts of things that the board of directors are now starting to focus on. Yes, you hope it's never going to happen, but if it were to, how would we respond? And how would we clean up? And that's what's so important. It's practicing and rehearsing that. And that's certainly, I would say, over the last 18 months, something that we at the ISF have spent most of our time on our services side of the business, helping customers really focus on.
So the intention is there for many businesses. We know that. But half the problem is that the technology itself isn't static. You can actually employ a strategy that works today, but tomorrow it can be redundant. So that surely has to be the next question. How often should companies actually update their security strategies without running the risk of buying into technology, which becomes very expensive and potentially, in some instances, unnecessary?
Yeah, I think that it's an interesting question that you asked me there, because I think where I stand on this is that we are spending too much time as an industry banging the drum for security being separate from the business. It isn't. There isn't a business out there that isn't dependent upon technology in some way, shape, or form. If you are dependent upon technology, you have to have good security in place. And so the focus then shifts. So to the point about strategy, How often are you reviewing your business strategy would be my question. And security should be a component of that. They shouldn't be separate, because technology, security, they're all going to help you deliver your business strategy, whatever that may look like. So if you have a, I don't know, 3-year review, that's how often you should be rolling your security strategy into it. If it's a 6-month rolling review, which I happen to prefer because things move so much more quickly, to your point, then again, it's rolled into that as well. So where I think a lot of mistakes are made is by separating these two things out. And if we could bring them back together and view it much more holistically across the organizations, to the point I was making earlier about risk, then I think life will become a lot easier, not just for the security people who are always trying to get their message across, but also for the business side of the house who are desperately trying to understand what it is that they need to be doing.
Yeah, because look, what we're talking about here is a good cyber strategy relying on collaboration. In other words, the human. And that has to be the key thing, isn't it? That how do you actually bring together the two, strike that balance between security and humans? Because whenever we talk about technology in the wider world, the conversation tends to work on the basis that eventually the human will be redundant. We haven't got there yet. The two need to work together. How can you do that so that technology is not seen as a silver bullet that rubs out 1,000 potential sins?
Yeah, I think that for me, the future actually for the human is pretty bright. But I see the human having to work in collaboration with technology, as you're pointing out, and vice versa. So I don't see a day where AI would replace people entirely. I think that AI and other technology tools are just that. They are tools.
Right, but it's also upskilling people as well, though, because you've got a generation of workers who use technology in a certain way. You bring in the AI, and that's going to change the landscape in itself. So how can you actually prepare a workforce to use the current AI models which are available now in readiness for the future?
It's to your point about upskilling. You have to invest in training. You have to invest in actually looking at the skill sets that you need within your organization and making some hard calls, as to whether or not you do have the right capabilities within your organization. That doesn't necessarily mean that you have to get rid of a lot of people. It means you probably do need to invest significantly in upskilling and training and thinking very hard about how you're going to use some of that new technology. And again, I think there is a little bit of an illusion out there that suddenly you drop in AI and we can all walk away. The reality is that you have to spend a tremendous amount of time thinking through how those projects are going to work, looking at how they're then going to deliver value for you, and then changing them. Because then you begin to understand the actual power of the technology that you're implementing. And this is the sort of thing that certainly the financial services sector has been doing for a while. Pharmaceuticals have been doing it for a while. But there is this misconception, I think, for a lot of people that AI is just this easy to use thing, because we're all familiar with ChatGPT and its brothers.
That's at a very basic level.
But that's at a very, very basic level. Using it within an organization for real business value is not a trivial exercise.
It's more complex, definitely.
Oh, absolutely.
But what we're talking about here is restructuring workforces. That is the reality. And obviously, technology has exacerbated that need, especially given the cyber dangers which are out there. But also as well, a lot of companies have to wrestle with silos. Do you think that silos increase the vulnerability of businesses to cyber attacks?
I do. I also think that the silo slows business down. So I'm a big fan of everybody understanding what it is that the business is trying to do and fully understanding the role that they play in that, and also the interconnections between the different departments. So for instance, sales is never going to be any good without good marketing. Marketing is never going to be effective without understanding the way in which the business is running. Finance needs to have an overall view across all of that. I'm stating the obvious, but if you then put technology into that, those systems need to interrelate, and then throw AI into it as well. And you begin to see the sort of mesh that we're building here in terms of everybody needing to understand what's happening. Businesses are team sports. You have to have everybody understanding what they're trying to do, and everybody will have a different role, but it will be interlinked in some kind of way. So when we talk about things like cyber or we talk about technology, for me, the thing that perhaps we don't spend enough time talking about is the transformation that's required within the organization to get the best return from what we're actually doing. And that's where I think we're starting to see more people spending time now. And security is starting to drive that, because security has to be recognized in a new way. And so the security leaders are trying to find a different way of doing it. And that's where this whole transformational piece is coming in.
But do you also feel perhaps that the dangers, the risks posed by cyber attacks is perhaps strengthening the case to reduce remote working, to actually get people working together under the same roof, getting people to invest in the idea because you are ultimately working to protect the organisation from which all of us will benefit?
I don't think remote working, and some people may be surprised to hear me say this, I don't think remote working has anything to do with security.
You don't think it makes a company more vulnerable to cyber?
I don't actually. I think what it does do is it may emphasise certain areas that company needs to focus on better. So if I have a remote workforce, how do I make them secure? How do I communicate better with them? How do I have them understand why they need to do things? These are some of the things that we need to be spending our time. It's explaining the why. If I say to you, Juliet, if you want to access your bank account, there's this great new bank out there, and they've got all these great levels of security, you'll say, okay, that may be interesting. I say, the only downside, slight downside, take you an hour to log into your account.
Out of bank charges probably would have been the downside.
But you're not even going to go there, right? Yeah. So it's always about a trade-off.
Yeah, quick access.
So you need to look at why people need to do things. If I said to you that your money is going to be 100% safe, there are going to be zero bank charges, but it will take you longer to access it, you may do it. So we have to explain more why we're doing things, because technology is becoming more complex. Cyber security is becoming more complex, and we're making an assumption that people will know why it's necessary, and actually they don't. So I think from a business perspective, leaders need to spend more time explaining what they're doing and why they're doing it, and then you'll bring people along with you.
Yeah, to get that multiple sense of investment. But I mean, look, there are so many pressures in that business space, and obviously cybersecurity underscores that. But how are cybersecurity teams actually evolving so that they can better align with the business goals of a company? Because the bottom line is that businesses are there to produce the goods, to ultimately produce a profit from which the shareholders and others will benefit.
Mm. And it's something that we've spent a lot of time looking at, and we've talked about putting security into the business so that you have somebody actually working with the business department who can provide that advice and guidance in the moment. We've looked at re-educating, upskilling the board, for instance. And the answer is it's all of those different things. For me, it's about how do you completely integrate security into your business strategy? If you can do that, some of these problems just go away. So you don't have this almost territorial dispute between what should security be doing and what should the business be doing. We have to work better together. You talked earlier about the need for collaboration. That's absolutely fundamental to a successful business going forward. And security teams need to be reaching out. The business is not going to do that because, as you rightly point out, they're concerned with how do I increase sales? How do I generate more margin, particularly at the moment, because everybody is finding the going a little bit tricky in the economic climate that we're in. So it is about security making the case for why they can add value, how they can protect what is important to the business. So I'm not one that says that the business needs to be spending all of its time learning how security operates. I think it has to be the other way. And lots of security people obviously disagree with me on that, but that's my opinion.
Look, the bottom line is that businesses are operating in a highly competitive landscape. There are all sorts of dangers, etc. There are some things over which they do have control, but other things outside of their control. We were talking about skills in terms of upskilling internally, but it's finding the professionals outside of an organisation to bring them in. And the reality is that there is a shortage of good skills, and particularly the sort of skills that can take on the cybersecurity challenges. That is worrying. The worry, I guess, is that whatever you do, whatever your strategy, it can be undermined if you don't have that flow of talent coming in through a pipeline.
That's absolutely right. We've talked for years in the industry about lack of skills. We've contributed to some of that problem ourselves by setting the bar too high. So we do expect people to be the finished article when they come into a security department. That isn't necessarily the case. I mean, certainly I look much more for aptitude, for interest, for ability, the willingness to learn. And you can get those sorts of skill sets from people who studied the arts, from people who've done all sorts of different things. So I think from an industry standpoint, we need to be more open-minded. There's no doubt, though, that we need also to be investing in people who are coming through our school and education systems. Apprenticeship programs, they're fundamental. I think that we need to be spending very much more on that. Now, the sad thing in the UK, of course, is that the cost of hiring has increased quite considerably. And so very many organizations are not proceeding with some of these schemes that we're talking about. And that is very short-sighted. So I think that we do need to be encouraging younger talent. We need to be giving them the opportunity through apprenticeship programs, through work experience. And we just need to be much more realistic about what is possible and what's available and working with what we've got rather than, I think, perhaps sitting back and bemoaning the fact that we can't get the right skills. Because at the end of the day, the business still has to function.
Slightly cheeky question on which to end. I'm going to ask it anyway. Who is the more important, the CEO or the Chief Technology Officer?
As a CEO, I would have to say the CEO.
But speaking outside of that.
I would still say the CEO because that's where the buck stops. And the CEO's job is to make sure that he or she understands everything that's going on across that business. And he or she is the person who, when it all goes wrong, is there to explain to the board why. And also, of course, to the public in the event that the press get their hands on it.
Because I guess the argument would be the Chief Technology Officer sets up the strategy, the structure, etc. So maybe they're more important than the figurehead.
I think they have to work collaboratively. I think that's the key to it. And I think in most successful businesses, that is what you're now finding.
Steve, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Well, sadly, we've run out of time. But Steve Durbin, Chief Executive of the Information Security Forum, or the ISF, thank you so much for joining me. I'm Juliet Foster, and you've been watching Business Matters.
That was ISF CEO Steve Durbin with Juliet Foster of Business Matters. We'll be back next week with another episode. If you enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast. And we'd be pleased if you'd consider sharing the episode. To become an ISF member, get in touch with Steve directly at steve.durbin@securityforum.org or on LinkedIn. Check out all our media and resources. All of it is there to support you at securityforum.org. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox Productions and Tavia Gilbert. Thanks for listening.